From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Spring seems to have arrived after a winter that nearly wasn't. The odd weather this season has a lot of us thinking about climate change. Today we focus on how climate change is altering seasonal events in the natural world, things like migration, hibernation, and pollination. The study of the timing of biological events like these is called phenology, and UMBC ecologist Colin Studs says in nature, timing is everything.
If you think about the unrolling of leaves and blooming of flowers as the setting on the table, a lot of things depend on just that perfect timing. The insects that eat the leaves, the birds that eat the insects.
Out of sync in a warming world. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Today we're going to talk about something that's on a lot of our minds lately, given this balmy winter we're having, climate change. We're focusing today on the effects climate change is having on the rhythms of the natural world, seasonal events like animal migration, flowers blooming, hibernation. The study of the timing of biological events is called phenology, and my guest, Colin Studs, is an expert. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
So, Colin, daffodils and crocuses are blooming, and the cherry blossoms in Washington are predicted to hit peak bloom next week, more than 2 weeks ahead of average. Is there any way to know whether this warm winter is the result of climate change?
Well, what we feel on an average day is weather. When we think about climate, that's something that's happening over a long period of time, decades or more. And so what we see now is consistent with what we think is happening with climate change, but it takes a lot of these events like we had in January and February to put together a big picture of climate change.
And when you talk about the events of January and February, you're talking about the warm temperatures.
That's right. The estimate is we were 8.5 degrees above normal, what a normal February would be. That's an enormous amount. And it's actually was 1 degree warmer than the average March, and that was February.
So what does a warm winter like that mean for migratory birds, for example?
Migratory birds are hit hard by this type of thing. When we see leaves coming out, which is going to happen really soon, if you look around, you can see that those red buds swelling on trees, those are maples, and they'll be out any minute now. So migratory birds don't know anything about that. The migratory birds that we have here are down in the Caribbean, Central and South America, and they have no way of knowing that it's getting warmer. They leave on their migrations when the days get longer. That's their big cue. And so when they arrive here, you can think of the phenology that's happening earlier as the setting on the table. And dinner's about to be served. All the insects that they'll have to eat and to feed their young, that's happening much earlier. So by the time they arrive here to set up their nests and have eggs, they're really late. And so it means that they have to work that much harder to feed their young. And they have to spend a lot of energy. And that can have a big effect on their ability to be successful at raising young. And it means that they might end up surviving worse than they normally would.
I didn't expect it to be such a bleak picture. Isn't there any good news for them in the fact that we're busy warming things up for them here in the north?
In the long term, in an evolutionary sense, birds are very good at timing their breeding when phenology is at its peak, when the insects that feed on the leaves are hitting their most abundant. And so when events like this February happen, and spring and summer happening earlier, probably about a month earlier than usual, then those birds are put at a disadvantage because they have only a set amount of time before they have to return on migration to the Caribbean to have their young. So if they lose a nest to a predator, they don't have enough time to replace that second nest. It means that overall, the chances are that they won't be as successful at raising their young this year.
What about pollinators like bees and butterflies? Will they emerge too late after the flowers that they need have bloomed off?
It's hard to tell. In most cases, pollinators are pretty good at responding to temperature, but they'll be a little bit late. We've become really good at measuring things like how flowers and trees respond to climate. Understanding the consequences, like for pollinators and migratory birds, we're just beginning to put that picture together.
How important is timing to the functioning of an ecosystem?
Again, if you think about the unrolling of leaves and blooming of flowers as the setting on the table, a lot of things depend on just that perfect timing. The insects that eat the leaves, the birds that eat the insects. It's not just warmer springs. We're also getting less snow cover at high elevations and indeed everywhere, and warmer, drier summers. And so things like hibernating mammals, they actually depend on snow to keep their burrows warm during the winter. Snow acts like an insulating blanket, and so we don't have snow. These mammals have a harder time surviving a cold winter. They actually experience more cold. And when they do come out, the hotter, drier summers mean they have a harder time getting the food they need to eat, especially if the phenology has gone forward and is advanced like this spring. So it means that everything gets out of sync. So in some cases, yeah, ecosystems can be really stressed.
That's Colin Studs here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. He is a UMBC ecologist, and we're talking about how climate change is affecting the timing of biological events like migration. So you're studying how climate change has affected the timing of natural events. Don't you need data from the past? I mean, how do you figure out when a particular species of tree leafed out 100 years ago?
Well, it turns out we have some really fantastic, really long-term data sets. Some of the best are from the blooming of trees. Probably the record winner for the longest data set is from cherry blossoms in Japan. It's been a very important part of culture there for a long time. There have been researchers who have discovered records going back to the 11th century monks kept track of the blooming date of cherries. What they found is there were dramatic fluctuations in temperature. One year would be very warm, the other year would be less warm. But it's not until we get to the beginning of the 20th century and into the 1950s where we start to see a big trend for much earlier blooming. Based on this 1,000-year data set, scientists could reconstruct what they think the temperature should have been. And it turns out temperatures risen by about 7 degrees Fahrenheit in Japan over that time. And as a consequence, the cherries have bloomed on average about 20 to 25 days earlier than in the past. That much change has happened since about the 1950s.
You must need a tremendous amount of data to make conclusions about an entire group of organisms. Is this a field where citizen science comes into play?
Absolutely. Citizen scientists are critically important. There are fantastic citizen science efforts that are curated in places like the National Phenology Network.
National Phenology Network.
It's a clearinghouse for all sorts of phenology data, and much of it collected by citizen scientists. And so one of the most well-known and useful databases is the timing that lilacs flower in people's yards. And so there are observers all over the country who send in information about that. And that data goes back about 60 years right now. And it's been useful. I've used it myself.
So this is ordinary people walking out in their own yards and saying, the lilacs have bloomed that hadn't bloomed yesterday?
Exactly right. Lilacs are one of those flowering species that when it's in bloom, it's really obvious. Lilacs in and of themselves may not tell us much about the phenology of everything else, but it is useful because lots of people have them in their yards, and so it's a great indicator.
Besides lilacs, what kinds of bloomings, buddings, arrivals do citizen scientists create databases on?
Well, all sorts. One of the things that citizen science has been incredibly useful for is the study of birds. All over the world, in North America, Europe in particular, people are crazy about birds. They're colorful, they're beautiful, and people love to go out and watch them. And so there are a number of organizations that have helped by helping citizen scientists have a place to put those data. One of them we have here in North America is the North American Breeding Bird Survey, which is housed just down the road at the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. A citizen scientist can go out and count birds along the roadside and then send that information in. That data has been collected since, again, about the 1950s. And it's been tremendously useful for understanding how not just things like climate, but changing land use have affected birds.
If somebody wants to gather data and have it mean something, how can they make contact with somebody who's actually organizing a database?
Fortunately, all these places have an online presence. You could search the web for National Phenology Network, the North American Breeding Bird Survey, and you can sign up to be a part of that.
Some people may be listening to us talk and think, well, okay, if climate is changing at the same time for all organisms, why are we seeing mismatches between the organisms? I mean, why don't they all just shift in unison?
It's a good question. From what we understand now, there are a lot of animals that can shift. There are great examples of butterflies and some bird species that have moved their ranges north as temperatures have increased. Usually that means that it's getting warmer further north. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has plant hardiness zones, which tell you where you can plant certain plants based on where you live. And in our region, we've changed our hardiness zone to the point where we can now plant plants here that formerly occurred in Georgia. So many things have to move north if they're going to cope with climate change. Some species who have big ranges, they're distributed all over the place, they can move. But some species have really particular habitat requirements. They need just the right kind of plants to be where they are, just the right kind of food. Those species, the type of species that can be marooned as climate change goes forward, many won't be able to shift north until the plants they depend on also move north. And that could take a long time. So there's a huge question mark. We just don't know whether plants will be able to do that. We've built a lot of barriers, highways and large housing developments that might make it hard for plants to move, therefore for the animals to move with them.
We need to take a break here. It is Pledge Drive at WYPR. In a minute or so, we'll pick up our conversation on the record about how a warming planet is affecting the seasonal cycles of organisms, from insects to plants to mammals.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Okay, back on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a scientific field called phenology, the study of timing in nature, when plants leaf out, when eggs hatch, when animals hibernate. Climate change is altering some of those patterns, and that's our focus today. My guest is Colin Studs, assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at UMBC. Colin, you study a migratory songbird called the American Redstart, which I confess I had not heard of. What have you learned about how climate change is affecting the American Redstart?
Well, it's a complicated but very interesting story. It's one of the things that's changing with climate is rainfall. We often think of temperature as being that big thing that's changing, but rainfall patterns are changing all over the world. And in Jamaica, where we study these birds, it's getting drier and drier. So as it gets drier and drier, it means the birds have fewer insects to eat. They only eat insects. And so when their food is low, it means they're not as well prepared to leave on migration. So even though I told you before that lengthening daylight gives birds the cue for when they should leave on migration, when they don't have enough to eat, it makes them leave late. They start to think about going, but if they don't have enough food to fatten up to get ready to migrate, they stay put. In times when birds don't have food, they might leave up to 5 days to 2 weeks later than they normally would.
Which just amazes me because I have a hard time remembering the bird there doesn't realize what the destination looks and feels like. It's warmer here. I would have thought birds show up earlier, and yet you find this bird shows up later.
That's right. So they're getting a 1-2 punch by climate change. drought is making them leave later from Jamaica. And when they get up here, if spring is happening earlier, they have to migrate even further north in order to find that sweet spot where they can have their young, where phenology is just right. So it means that on average, many of them have to migrate further than they normally would. Migration is a very hazardous affair for migratory animals. So when they have to fly longer, they actually have a higher chance of dying on migration.
You've mentioned a couple of cues just then. You talked about the normal cue to a migratory bird being the length of the day. When I have this much daylight or this much dark, time to get on the road. But you said that's countered then if they don't have the strength to do it. Is it always clear what the cue is that an organism is responding to? And do they all respond in a given species to the cues the same way?
Things are a little bit different for every species, but across the animal kingdom, we see lengthening days being the major overriding cue for everything. That's when organisms want to start making their changes, breeding, heading south. But we know that changes in the environment can change that cycle a little bit. It's like the case with American redstarts.
Why so much research on birds?
Well, I guess they're the proverbial canary in the coal mine. Birds are really visible. They're easy to watch, and people are really enthusiastic about them. All over the world, it's not just here. There are fantastic long-term records of people watching birds arrive in a place and leave from a place. We didn't know 50, 100 years ago that we would have a need to study climate. So we rely on these data sets that existed that can help us understand a little bit about climate change. And it happens that birds fit that bill perfectly.
I have the sense that you think more species are disadvantaged than helped by any of this. I mean, what are the odds that species will be able to adapt to changing climate?
It's a tricky question. We've become really good at finding out the kinds of things we need to look at to understand that, yes, climate is changing. But we're really only starting to get a good sense about whether species will be able to cope with that change. Many things will benefit. One example are disease-causing mosquitoes. For example, the mosquitoes that bring dengue fever, Zika virus. These species will be able to shift their range north. And in fact, right now, in the summer months, we can get those mosquitoes as far north as Baltimore and Washington, D.C. Warming temperatures like this could help them spread further north. In a normal year, places like South Texas and Southern Florida can have these mosquitoes all year round. If we keep getting warm winters like this, we could have these mosquitoes all year round here. And that's nice for the mosquito, but not so nice for the humans who are prone to these really important diseases. In general, species that can make their living all over the place, that are cosmopolitan, like a mosquito or a house sparrow, things that we think of as really common, those are the things that are really good at moving around, right? They can go wherever they need to. So they'll likely be the first winners in climate change. And it's those species that either migrate to far away, who have no way of knowing what's happening each year, whether they should come earlier or later, or species that are already rare because they need one kind of plant, those are likely to be the losers of climate change, the ones that won't be able to move fast enough.
I realize climate change doesn't move year to year, month to month in a straight line. It squiggles around. So I'm not asking you to predict next year, but as you look at the climate change that you have observed in your work over the time you've been observing it, do you have a sense of where this is going over, say, the next decade?
One thing is for sure is that we are probably headed for a much warmer world. We know that one of the big causes of the warming that we see over a long term is the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So right now we have a number that doesn't mean that much when you say it by itself. Our atmosphere is somewhere north of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide. It's the most that we've had in about 400,000 years. The lowest we can think about is during the last period where glaciers covered the Earth, we had about 200 parts per million. And so as the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increases from things like fossil fuel burning, that causes things to get warmer. We might be at a point where we could see plants blooming even earlier each year. The problem comes when plants can't cope with constant blooming. Most plants that we have around here, they need to bloom and they need to go into a dormant period where they're not doing anything. That's part of their life cycle. So it's really hard to predict what will happen with more warming and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We could likely see plants just not able to carry out their life cycle.
This is very sobering, but very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colin Studs is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm Sheila Cast. You're listening to On the Record on WIPR.